Welcome to the podcast, Text to Task, Simplifying Education. In a world brimming with screens and notifications, it's all too easy to fall victim to the siren call of digital distractions. From social media updates to endless email threads, our attention is constantly pulled in different directions, often at the expense of our focus and productivity. But what exactly lies behind this phenomenon? How do digital distractions impact our cognitive processes and ultimately our ability to learn and thrive in an increasingly connected world? To shed light on this topic, we are joined by an esteemed expert in the field of educational psychology, Dr. Abraham E. Flanagan. Dr. Flanagan is an assistant professor at Georgia Southern University, where he delves deep into the intricacies of human learning and cognition. With a PhD in educational psychology, Dr. Flanagan brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise to the table. Not only is Dr. Flanagan a leading figure in his field, but he also holds the prestigious position of senior chair at the American Education Research Association Studying and Self-Regulated Learning Special Interest Group. Enjoying your time today? You can help others find these podcasts by liking and sharing this podcast. Be sure to subscribe to my monthly podcast. I'm really grateful for your support. Join us for engaging conversations with educators and scholars from around the world. Thank you, Professor Abraham Flanagan, for this podcast interview. I appreciate it greatly.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Today, we are diving deep into strategies for creating an optimal learning environment and understanding the dynamics of student success. Firstly, let's talk about fostering a supportive environment. What practical strategies can educators employ to foster a supportive environment that enhances the learning experience, considering the unique challenges posed by synchronous and asynchronous classroom? It is a mouthful of question, so please go ahead.
Sure, yeah, I mean, there's the question talks about synchronous, asynchronous learning environments, but I think that both environments, oddly enough, share a lot of similarities in what they ask of the instructor. So when I think of fostering a supportive learning environment, I immediately start to think about the importance of cultivating a strong sense of student-instructor rapport. And in general, we can kind of define rapport as the sense of a harmonious interpersonal relationship between two people that's characterized by a strong sense of trust, caring, and open communication. So from the student's perspective, it's the perception that, you know, my instructor cares about me, values me both personally and professionally, and acts in good faith in ways that support me. And so if we can cultivate a strong sense of rapport from our students, then I believe that they're going to feel supported in whatever environment that we're in. And for me, I think that cultivating a sense of student-instructor rapport is kind of central to my instructional design and my role as a college educator. We know that student perceptions of rapport positively linked and predictive of what I kind of think to be the big three outcomes that I'm most concerned with: motivation, engagement, and learning. And so because of this, you know, being mindful and purposeful about cultivating a strong sense of rapport from our students, I think is really, really important for student success and fostering that kind of supportive environment that you asked me about, particularly in asynchronous online courses where students, you know, they can feel isolated, feel a lack of connectedness with their instructors and with their other classmates. And these negative emotions can lead to problems with learning and with retention in asynchronous environments and in synchronous, you know, online courses as well. So online courses can be pretty isolating for students. You know, they're separated from each other by the screen. And so in online courses, but also in face-to-face courses, if we want to cultivate a supportive environment, you know, doing things that cultivate a strong sense of rapport from our students, yeah, I think it is pretty foundational. There's a whole bunch of different strategies that we can use, to cultivate rapport. I've written and published on quite a few of them, but just a few basic recommendations that I think people can kind of easily take from this podcast and use. First would be creating a student-centered syllabus. And so in a lot of our courses, the syllabus is our students' introduction to us. You know, we often think of it as this document that just contains policies and procedures, but really the syllabus is our students' introduction to us and to the course. And there's kind of two ways that we can think about the syllabus. We can think about it as being written instructor-oriented language versus student-centered language. So syllabi that are written in instructor-centered syllabi, you know, they don't really provide a rationale for policies. They're written in an impersonal tone, and rules are kind of written as directives. So it's just kind of a listing of, you know, here's our course grading policies or attendance policies, and here's the consequences you're going to receive if you violate these policies. And so it's kind of written in cold, unwelcoming language. Now, the instructor might appear unapproachable. Student-centered syllabus is written in more personable, warm, welcoming, inviting language. So rationales are provided for course policies. The instructor not only just provides, you know, let's think about like your office hours. Rather than just listing the day and time when the office hours are going to be available, encouraging students, or having statements in the syllabus that are written to encourage students to swing by if they have questions, you know, invite them to reach out to you, show them that you're not scary. And so if we write syllabi using that student-centered language, that can give them a positive first impression of us. Giving students input in course design and policies. So we know from motivation literature that students really like having a sense of choice. It's powerful. But we also know from the rapport literature that giving students choice shows them that we're trying to be considerate to their needs and trying to be responsive to them. So we can do things like waiting to schedule our office hours until we know the days and times that work best for our students. We can give flexibility and choice in assignment formats. You know, do you want to write a paper, or do you want to record a video lesson, or create your own little podcast episode? You know, giving students flexibility so that they can choose the format that best aligns with their strengths and preferences. And giving them input on course technology policies. And also sitting down with your students and talking about what is appropriate versus inappropriate use of digital devices in our classroom. You know, I think that these are the kinds of strategies that we can use to get started, you know, right there at the beginning of a semester that, you know, allows us to humanize ourselves to our students, show them that we're trying to be attentive to their needs, and that we care about their success. And I think if we're purposeful about doing these things, then my research and other studies indicate that we can create, you know, the kind of supportive environment the students respond positively to, and that positively affects their motivation, engagement, and learning, the kind of those big three outcomes I talked about earlier.
Moving on to a modern challenge, how can students strike a balance between using technology for learning and avoiding digital distractions?
All right, so first off, and I hate to admit it because, you know, I consider myself a digital distractions researcher, and so, you know, most of my focus is on trying to minimize student digital distraction. But I think that we would be kidding ourselves if we didn't acknowledge that a certain amount of digital distraction is pretty much bound to happen in classrooms where students have access to their devices. Like, it just is. And there's a considerable body of research that shows that college students spend anywhere from 20 to 30% of a typical class period, you know, misusing their mobile devices for off-task purposes, things like their smartphones. Students who bring their laptops with them to class, you know, they spend about 50% of the class period misusing their devices. And so digital distraction is pretty rampant in college classrooms. And, you know, that doesn't mean that we should throw in the towel and surrender, just assume there's nothing that we can do about it. But I do think that it's important to acknowledge, you know, that a certain amount of digital distraction at this point, almost normative, unfortunately. And actually, my own research, we published a study where we interviewed undergrads about their experiences with digital distraction. And a lot of those participants in that study and then in some other studies have found the same thing, that students, undergrads, they kind of consciously choose to misuse their devices during class, so they decide that they want to do it, even though they're aware that it limits their attention and hinders their learning. So even when students make a conscious, you know, cost-benefit analysis in deciding whether or not to misuse their devices, a lot of them still decide to do so because they're willing to make that sacrifice. And I know that that probably sounds crazy to you, it sounds crazy to me, and probably to your listeners, but you know, I think that's the case for quite a few students. And so, like I said, that doesn't mean we should throw in the towel and just surrender. You know, as a college instructor, there's strategies that we can and should use to try to minimize student digital distraction as best we can. You know, in other words, I think that instructors should be active in helping their students make good technology decisions during class. And a few strategies that instructors can use, you know, first is consciousness raising. And so I think that there's a lot of students who don't really fully understand the impact that digital distraction can have on them during class. They think they can multitask, but we can't. We can't multitask. We task switch. We focus our attention from one stimulus, and then we switch it over to the other and then back. So we're not really multitasking, we're task switching. I think that raising student awareness about that, you know, kind of tearing down the myth that they believe that they can multitask, you know, showing them the literature on digital distractions, you know, telling them what are the downsides for it, you know, why is it negative, why is it consequential. Now, I think that consciousness raising is kind of the first step. We need them to understand that it's a problem. So I said earlier that they're willing to live with the consequences of their actions oftentimes. And like I said, they're willing to use their devices even though they know it hinders their learning. I'm not so sure they understand how much it actually hinders their learning. So making sure that we're all on the same page about that, using that kind of consciousness raising strategy, I think is really important if we want to shape and modify student learning. The second thing that we can do, you know, I mentioned earlier the importance of giving students options and choice, involving students in the design of course technology policies, in addition to positively affecting rapport. When students co-design policies with their instructors, students tend to view those policies and actually their instructors as being more credible, and they're more likely to adhere to those policies when they're co-constructed between students and instructors. So at the beginning of the semester, sitting down with students, talking to them about, you know, so what are we going to allow as appropriate use of devices in our class versus inappropriate use of devices in our class. And so we start off the semester by consciousness raising, and then we go into policy design. And so that way we can refer back to those policies that were co-constructed between us and the students and the rationales for why we constructed those policies in the first place, you know, from that consciousness raising. So I think those are two strategies that we can use, you know, to kind of help students understand that, you know, there is a balance between my use of devices for on-task purposes and off-task purposes. And, you know, that if you weigh that out, you know, the scales tip in a negative direction the more that they succumb to digital distraction. And I also think that we can help them understand how often they succumb to digital distraction by doing things like incorporating written self-monitoring reflections into our courses. So just periodically, and I know that this probably doesn't have anything to do with the content that's being taught in our courses. You know, the content is kind of the product of learning. That's the things we want students to know. That's what we want them to gain from learning. But learning is also a process, and we want the students to have an effective learning process if we expect them to be successful in our courses. So we could periodically throughout a semester, you know, have students just engage in written reflections on how often am I misusing my devices in this class? How often am I misusing devices while I'm studying or doing homework for this class? And how do I think that that's affecting my attention, my engagement in my learning? So if we can get students to be kind of self-regulated learners, reflect on their digital device use, I think that we can open their eyes and get them to see just how consequential it actually is for them. You know, so get them to understand the magnitude of how impactful digital distraction really is for engagement and for learning.
So you've already touched upon what educators can do, how teachers can teach students about digital distraction and all. But I just want to move a little farther along that way. So how we can then teach effective digital literacy and focus to the students?
Yeah, so like I said, you know, helping students make good decisions about their digital device use is becoming more important, you know, by the year, by the month, by the week. You know, and it's definitely something that I'm, like I said, I'm conscious of when I teach my courses. But I think it's also important to note that college instructors, this isn't a universally agreed upon shared responsibility among college instructors. Actually, my research and other studies have shown that college educators, for the most part, can be sorted into one of two camps. In the first camp, we've got the educators who believe that it's up to the students to make good decisions about technology use in the classroom. You know, if the students want to distract themselves, then let them distract themselves. They're adults, it's their choice. And my role in the instructor is just to communicate course content and teach you. It's not to babysit you and your device use. So that's one camp, kind of the non-interventionist. In the other camp are the educators who believe that it's their responsibility to address and try to curb digital distraction out of their mission to protect the integrity of the learning environment. Right? So I'm definitely part of that second camp. You know, I think it's my responsibility to protect the integrity of the classroom learning environment by trying to address student digital distraction. We know that misuse of digital devices during class negatively impacts the learning and the engagement of the students who are misusing the devices. But we also know that students who are kind of seated nearby classmates who are misusing the devices, they can get distracted by their peers misusing their devices. You know, like somebody sitting in front of me is scrolling through social media, looking at pictures or watching a movie on their laptop. You know, I'm going to see that, I'm going to get distracted too. Right. And so it's not just, you know, the folks in that first camp who say that college students are adults, it's their decision if they want to be distracted. You know, maybe that's true, but their distraction also distracts other students seated nearby. Right. And so, you know, we don't want those students to have their learning negatively affected because we just ignored the problem. And so as far as what educators in that second camp can do to help students focus and to avoid succumbing to digital distraction, you know, I think I just circle back to my answer to the previous question about consciousness raising, creating and enforcing policies that differentiate between appropriate and inappropriate device use, and embedding strategies like having students do a self-monitoring written reflection that encourage and scaffold self-regulation of learning. But one more thing I'd like to add though is that the ways in which college educators go about enforcing their course policies can have like huge implications for students' perceptions of rapport with. So me and some colleagues published a study last year where we looked at that. We looked at different instructor strategies for how to respond when you see a student misusing their devices during class. And we saw that depending upon the strategies that instructors used to enforce their policies, had pretty big implications for students' perceptions of rapport with them. So if you see a student digitally distracted during class and you respond too harshly, you know, you call them out, you deduct points, you yell at them in front of their classmates, you confiscate their device, whatever. If you respond too harshly in the eyes of the students, their perceptions of rapport is going to sour, and the perceptions of other students, you know, who are seated nearby and who see it happen, their perceptions of rapport can sour as well. So you don't want to respond too harshly, because although that probably will effectively address the digital distraction problem, now you've created a rapport problem. But if you respond too gently when you see students misusing their devices, then you run the risk of the device misuse just continuing. Right? So it's kind of a tough spot for educators to be. A couple of more tactful ways that we can respond when we observe students misusing their devices. You know, if we co-constructed our course technology policy with our students, you know, we can provide, you know, kind of a verbal oral reminder to the whole class. You know, so if I see Billy misusing his device, rather than call out Billy, I can just stop teaching for a moment, you know, tell the students in the classroom, hey, you know, I'm seeing some device misuse. You know, we agreed that this was appropriate versus this was inappropriate. Here's what I'm seeing right now. And so I'm just going to give you all a minute to put your devices away, and we're going to get back going on the lesson. All right, so there I've avoided calling the student out. That's a whole lot better than kind of getting on them in front of their classmates, emailing the offending students or talking with them privately after class. So I see Jake misusing his devices. I give that oral reminder to everybody, wait for the devices to get put away and continue on with instruction. And then after class, you know, email him or talk with him privately after class and tell him what I saw. You know, don't write his case too hard, because if you do that, then you know, certainly today's students can be off put by that. You know, and so my recommendations would be to try to respond as tactfully as possible when we see student digital distraction occur, because like I said, if we respond harshly, we might solve the digital distraction problem, at least for a short period of time, but then we've created a rapport problem, which we want to avoid as well.
So Abraham, you have done a lot of work on mindset in learning and achievement also. So my last question to you is, how might teachers promote a positive mindset among their students to enhance learning and achievement?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as time has gone on, I've become a bigger and bigger believer in the importance of basic psychological needs theory, which is drawn from self-determination theory. And basic psychological needs theory is this idea that satisfying our students' basic needs for competence, autonomy, and relatedness in the classroom promote well-being and learning. So by competence, I mean their beliefs about their ability to understand and perform the skills or the knowledge that we want them to learn and to master in our courses. So we want to improve their perception that they have the competence needed to succeed. The need for autonomy refers to giving students a sense of control or ownership over the direction of their learning. And then relatedness refers to perceiving a sense of interpersonal connectedness. You know, kind of going back to rapport that I mentioned a little bit ago. And so if we satisfy these needs for our students, then we can promote a positive mindset in the learning environment. And so when I talk about, you know, satisfying these basic needs, we can promote well-being. You know, by well-being, I'm referring to adaptive, motivational, and emotional factors like students' motivation to learn, their belief in their ability to learn, you know, and their perceptions of rapport with their instructors. All of those things are important parts of student well-being in a face-to-face course, you know, or in an online course. And so by designing, by leading courses in ways that satisfy these three basic psychological needs, we can positively influence students' mindsets for learning. And we've already talked about some strategies to meet students' needs for autonomy and for relatedness. You know, we can bolster student perceptions of autonomy by giving them voice in the classroom, by doing things like co-constructing course technology policies, collaborating on them, and when should I hold my office hours? You know, so rather than scheduling office hours before the semester starts on a day and time that I pick, you know, I don't know when my students are available or not. So asking them what days, times work best for you, and then holding your office hours during a day and a time that works best for the greatest number of them, or giving students choice on assignments. All of these are ways that we can help students feel a sense of control and ownership over the learning environment. So all of those things would help satisfy their need for autonomy. We can help meet students' need for relatedness by engaging in the kinds of rapport building strategies that I talked about earlier. And we can help satisfy students' need for competence by giving them small wins early in the learning process, offering reinforcement and encouragement when students do well, when they have those wins, delivering personalized, constructive feedback, particularly that's strengths-based, and by focusing on learning as a process. It's a process that you can control through your actions and through your behaviors, and that learning and success don't just boil down to natural innate ability. And when we design classrooms and when we deliver instruction in ways that satisfy these three basic psychological needs, We're going to promote well-being. We're going to positively influence our students' mindsets for learning. And then ultimately, we're going to positively influence their learning and their achievement as well.
Thank you, Professor Flanagan, for joining us. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much. Like I said, I enjoyed being here. And thanks for having me.